Welcome to What That Means with Camille, companion episodes to the In Technology podcast. In this series, Camille asks top technical experts to explain, in plain English, commonly used terms in their field, then dives deeper, giving you insights into the hottest topics and arguments they face. Get the definition directly from those who are defining it. Now, here is Camille Morehart.
Hi, and welcome to today's episode of In Technology. I'm your host, Camille Morehart, and we have an episode on what that means, artificial general intelligence and cognitive architecture. I've got with me today Peter Voss, who is CEO and chief scientist of Igo.ai, and he's been working on artificial general intelligence for decades. He actually helped coin the term along with two other people for AGI. And his company now, Igo.ai, is working toward AGI, but in the meantime, it's also got a commercial chatbot platform, as he calls it, a chatbot with a brain, that's out there being used already by companies like 1-800-Flowers. So welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Yes, thanks for having me.
How did you initially become interested in artificial intelligence or AGI?
So I started out as an electronics engineer, started my own company doing electronics, and then I fell in love with software, and my company turned into a software company. We went from the garage to 400 people and did an IPO. So that was exciting. But when I left the company, it occurred to me that software really is quite dumb. You know, and I was proud of the software we'd created, but still, it doesn't have common sense. It can't reason. It can't learn the way, you know, humans can. So that is really what interested me then to pursue, is to figure out how to write software that can think, learn, and reason the way humans do. So I spent 5 years studying all different aspects of intelligence to really get a grounding, and then actually coined the term AGI together with two other people in 2002 and launched a company to ultimately develop AGI.
So this is kind of a big claim, so I'm going to pause on it. So you said you and two other people coined the term artificial general intelligence, or AGI as we'll refer to it. How did you coin it?
When I finished my research, I was ready to actually start building some prototypes and exploring building actual and achieving the technology. And I came across a few other people who were also interested in pursuing the original dream of AI, to build thinking machines. And so we decided to write a book together, and three of us decided on the book title. And we tried, you know, different ideas and so on. And then the three of us, Ben Goertzel, Shane Legg, and myself, we decided on artificial general intelligence. You know, we didn't know that the term would ultimately take off. And so, yeah, that book was written in 2002, was published in, I think, 2005.
We'll put a link down too if anybody's interested in taking a closer look. Let's start by actually defining AGI. I mean, what is general intelligence versus specific intelligence, or intelligence to begin with at all?
So the original vision of the founders of the field of AI, when they originally coined the term AI some 60 odd years ago, was to build thinking machines, machines that can think, learn, reason the way humans do. And they actually thought this could be achieved in like a year or two. Now, of course, it turned out to be a much, much harder problem than that. So what happened over the years and over the decades, the field of AI really turned into a field of narrow AI, mm-hmm. where you take one particular problem that you want to solve that seems to require intelligence, and you figure out how to automate that. And so a very good example here is IBM's Deep Blue, you know, the world chess champion in the 90s. It's really not that the software has the intelligence to figure out how to play chess. It's the ingenuity of the engineers to figure out how to use computers and put different algorithms together to play a good game of chess. And they can't even play a game of checkers. So it's really the external intelligence, the intelligence of the engineers, or today the data scientists, that achieve these particular narrow objectives. Now, of course, with ChatGPT and the massive amount of data that it's trained with, it has a much, much broader range of capabilities. But I'll come back and we can talk about the limitations and why that isn't really AGI. But really, the field of AI turned into narrow AI, and us coining the term of AGI was to get back to this ideal, to this vision of having thinking machines. And really, the most important thing here is a machine that can learn a very broad range of capabilities by itself. That would imply that it could become a scientist, a doctor, a researcher, a call center operator, or any of things by simply learning the way we use. So that's really what artificial general intelligence implies, the ability to have the core intelligence to be able to learn pretty much any skill that humans can, and of course, many more.
So one of the differences, there's an infinite number of differences between a human mind and a machine, or I'll say a computer machine, because people might argue the human mind is a machine. I'll leave that one for a moment. But the amount of energy that we consume to run our brains is pretty small. To train a computer or to train a model, you've got to have, an incredible amount of compute power. And then you have to have an incredible amount of data, whereas a human can be shown sort of one picture and then kind of understand that picture in a variety of different contexts until some other thing happens that causes you to focus or narrow your perception of something. Whereas a computer might have to have, millions and millions of pictures of, cats, right, before it really understands. Mm-hmm. Is that something that computers need to get to before they can achieve AGI, sort of a similar power consumption and similar single-shot learning, or is that not required? They can learn differently.
Yes. You actually put your finger right on the issue of why current approaches are not AGI and, in fact, will not get to AGI. There's a very common misunderstanding about what intelligence entails or what human intelligence entails. A lot of people make the mistake believing that having a lot of knowledge makes you intelligent, but that's not really the case. It's the ability to learn, to conceptualize, to generalize, and to think conceptually. That is really the hallmark of intelligence. So, you can have a person that has very, very little knowledge about really anything. Children would have that, but they had the ability to learn. And that is really the hallmark of intelligence, to be able to learn and to be able to learn largely by yourself. And LLMs can't do it. So when you're saying the current computers have massive requirement of data and computing power and energy, that's because they try to brute force it. It's all about having trillions of pieces of information to try and simulate something that looks like intelligence, but really isn't intelligence. So a truly intelligent AI wouldn't have that requirement. And exactly as you say, it could see one picture of a giraffe the first time they've ever seen a giraffe, and it would be able to recognize it the same way a child can. So this one-shot learning with very little data, and it's not about how much knowledge you have, but it's the ability to really deeply understand, to reason, and to be able to acquire knowledge. So the kind of systems that we are working on require a tiny, tiny fraction of training data and computing power and energy. And that really is ultimately what you want.
Humans have, 5 or 6 senses. And obviously we're aware of others that we use in machinery. But do you feel like computers are going to need a similar kind of sensory input? I know that there's arguments about autonomous driving and whether it can use vision or it needs, other kinds of technology in addition to it. But that would just be one example. What kinds of sensors do we need? Obviously, large language models are using writing, and possibly that'll extend to video. But what other kinds of things?
Right. It's a very interesting question. And I don't know that we know for sure how little sensors you can get away with. But I often talk about my theory of AGI as the Helen Hawking theory of AGI, Helen Keller and Stephen Hawking. So if you take a Helen Keller with very limited sense acuity and you take a Stephen Hawking with very limited dexterity, obviously they were both very intelligent people. So clearly you can be an intelligent being with very limited sense acuity and dexterity. And that's actually the approach we are following. because it's easier, that we don't have to deal with robotics and all of the complications. So exactly how little sense acuity you can get away with and still have the level of learning ability that you want is not totally clear yet. But it is clear that you don't need to have the full sense acuity that we have, for example.
Will machines be learning then always from observations that humans have already made? Or, you know, if it was one of the interesting ways people learn is they experience it themselves. You know, the machine itself is the microscope, or rather than reading something that a human observed, or that, I guess, would be my curiosity around why you might need a sensor.
Yes. So our commercial system is text only, but our AGI development system has vision and, of course, text input as well. And I think there is something like either vision or tactile is required to really internalize a 3D world. Mm-hmm. I mean, Helen Keller could clearly feel things around her. So I do believe that some form of vision is really essential for grounding the sort of three-dimensional, four-dimensional experience that we have or that an intelligent entity needs to have. It will be able to learn, and what we are doing now is we're training it through interacting with a virtual world, but also potentially with the real world through, you know, cameras and other inputs. But it can also learn a lot through reading. But there's a very important difference in how you read. Whereas large language models, their approach is basically to dump gigabytes of PDFs or whatever and statistically build a model from that. And there really isn't understanding the way we would read a text. So, you know, if we read a technical paper, for example, or even a novel, we will read one sentence and immediately we ingest that sentence and we try to make sense of it. You know, is this something new? Is this something that confirms something we already know? Does it contradict it? What does it make you think of? Do you need to go off and do some other research? So we process the information as we go along. And this is really how understanding and intelligent learning has to work. And perhaps ask for help, ask for clarification if you don't understand that you have a teacher. So that is a way we see an AGI learning, by interacting with the world to some extent, but also by hitting the books.
I think what you're talking about is essentially comparing new information or new input with existing patterns of thought or context. So a lot of that seems to me based on memory for at least humans. I'm retrieving files or understandings of things that I've come across before. So how does AGI, or how do I suppose Gen AI today, how are they approaching like short-term, long-term memory or understanding the context of a situation?
Yeah, I'd like to take a little detour and talk about a model that DARPA published a few years ago, and they call it the three waves of AI. And according to DARPA, the first wave of AI is what we now also call good old-fashioned AI. It's basically the work that was done in the 70s, 80s, 90s, which is largely logic-based approaches, some statistical, but really mathematical, logical approaches like expert systems and so on. And the second wave is basically hit us like a tsunami about 12 years ago. And that is all about deep learning, machine learning, and now generative AI, so statistical systems. And what happened there is obviously some big companies had a lot of data, had a lot of computing power. So it was sort of, what can we do with that? In a way, it's just a hammer we've got, so everything looks like a nail. And they managed to do a lot with this big data approach. Now, the third wave of AI, according to DARPA, really starts with understanding cognition, what cognition requires, what intelligence requires. And memory is one of the requirements, but it's not just short-term memory and long-term memory. Short-term memory is very important, but it's really how you use the short-term memory, is that it forms part of the context of understanding. Who are you talking to? What is the subject you're talking? Theory of mind, what does the other person already know? What was said earlier? What assumptions? What is the goal that you're trying to achieve? So all of those things are partly short-term memory, partly called from long-term memory. And that serves as a context for being able to really make sense of what you're doing and to have the appropriate response and the appropriate thought patterns. So that is really what the cognitive AI approach is. Now, current large language models, whatever memory they have is really external to the model. Mm-hmm. The model itself is read-only. I mean, if you just look at GPT, G means generative, which means it makes up stuff, which, you know, for better or for worse, it has trillions of pieces of information, good, bad, and ugly. And it basically statistically generates things from there. So that's the generative part. But the P stands for pre-trained. Mm-hmm. It's trained at the factory for $100 million or more. And the model itself is read-only. It does not change as it comes across new information or whatever. The new information that you have is either stored in an external database that is indexed, but it's still external. It doesn't change the model. Or it's part of the context window, which means it's short-term memory that is kind of fed in to the model as you do inference. But again, it's not integrated. And there are also severe limitations with how much information you can actually put into this short-term memory. So that's really a very fundamental limitation of large language models, that the model itself cannot change, cannot learn in real time.
Is that in perpetuity, or is the assumption that it will be doing that in the future, but that we're kind of in early generations right now?
I didn't get to the third letter of GPT. I mean, the P already tells you it's pre-trained, but the T is it's transformer technology. So as long as we're using transformer technology, and that seems to be pretty deeply embedded in the whole LLM scene. I mean, people are now building chips based on transformer technology. So it's getting pretty much baked into the approach. And transformer technology inherently requires some kind of backpropagation, some bulk training, and it cannot learn in real time. There really aren't algorithms that allow you to update the model. You know, there's a little bit of fine tuning you can do at the output layer and so on, but really the core of the model cannot be updated. In fact, if somebody could figure out how you can train a system in bulk and then later update it in real time, the model, that would change my mind about the path we might take to AGI. I think there are some other problems with large language models, with GPT, that also prevent it from getting to AGI, and that is to do with the way concepts are formed. So statistically forming concepts is not really the same way that humans conceptualize. I'll give a simple example, which might not exactly explain it, but if you look at word-to-vec encoding, vector encoding, you find that dog and cat are closer in vector space than dog and puppy. And, you know, for us, dog and puppy seem to be closer related than dog and cat, but because in text, you far more frequently find dog and cat close together or mentioned together. So it's the way the vectors are encoded in these large language models. So I think there are really some fundamental limitations that are not fixable that will prevent large language models from getting to AGI.
How does AGI achieve what I guess humans would commonly call critical thinking, which is, I'm kind of tying it back to the LLM, because hallucinations, you know, how do you know, or how does it know, or how does whatever's interpreting it know that it's gone off the rails? You know, how are you finding the truth if the truth is what you want?
You know, one of the unique human features is that we have metacognition. We know what we're talking about. We know what we're thinking, well, at least to some degree, not very deeply. In fact, there's an interesting insight I got while I was studying intelligence. I actually spent quite a bit of time on a project developing a new, not exactly an IQ test, but a cognitive profile test. It was actually in South Africa that doesn't have cultural bias, which is really important in South Africa, that you could have a test that didn't have the bias of Western backgrounds. Long story short, one of the things I learned from that exercise, I ended up computerizing this test. And I learned that metacognition is actually the single most important dimension to predict general intelligence. So when people are good at automatically using the right mental technique that matches the problem well, they tend to be generally intelligent. So metacognition is essential. Now, Daniel Kahneman talks about system one thinking and system two thinking, and that's also very much related. System one thinking is sort of roughly speaking, most of our mental activity is just subconscious and automatic. Mm-hmm. But we have this supervisory function, the system two function, mm-hmm. that kind of monitors what we're thinking, what we're saying, and it can then redirect and correct us. Mm. And LLMs simply don't have that, whereas a cognitive AI approach clearly will need that and will have that higher level thinking, that reasoning.
Can you say a little bit more about the metacognition and what the using the right tech, just what humans are doing when you're using the right technique to, I'm going to solve this problem now, how am I going to think about it? Because that's not with the supervisor, that's in your head. That's just...
Correct, yeah. I mean, those are thinking skills. For humans, we're actually not particularly good at rational thinking. It's sort of an evolutionary afterthought. For an AI, it will actually be able to think much more rationally, but it has to have the mechanisms for doing that. So these are the mental skills that have to be learned by the system. And, you know, that's part of the curriculum, the training that we do, where we teach the system how to think critically and how to avoid logical fallacies and things like that. So it's really that you're training the system to think well. I do want to comment on something else you mentioned, that is, can LLMs not help with AGI? Absolutely. In fact, a few years ago, one of our biggest concerns in getting to AGI was always, how do we get the massive amount of common sense knowledge that you need to function in the real world and to understand the real world? Where do you get that? You know, it would take thousands of people years to teach AGI all of these things. I believe now that we have LLMs, we can actually use LLMs to extract information, as long as you have that supervisory function that basically makes sure, you know, you can cross-check different LLMs, you can ask things in a different way, you could potentially also double-check things in Wikipedia where appropriate or wherever. So I think that makes the problem of training an AGI, giving it common sense knowledge that it needs, a lot more tractable by having them. An AGI will inherently be a terrific tool user. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if my AGI, if I wanted to write a poem in a certain style, I would probably could just ask ChatGPT to do it, you know?
Right.
It doesn't have to have that ability by itself. It's not going to have the massive amount of knowledge that is embodied in a large language model, but it'll be an excellent tool user.
So, Peter, we didn't get into a lot specifically about Igo.ai. So can you explain a little bit about what your company is working on right now and what's out there commercially today?
Yeah, certainly. So the company really has two divisions. The one is the AGI division, and that's the part we've really been talking about, is to continually get closer and closer to human-level AI. And we are currently expanding that to accelerate development. But the other part of our business is the existing commercial business, where we have a chatbot with a brain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most chatbots are not that great and people get frustrated by them. So ours uses a cognitive architecture and it has short-term, long-term memory, ability to reason and so on. So we are targeting large call centers with that to really replace call center operators, because call centers have a really torrid time trying to get staff, to train staff and keep staff. So for example, one of our big customers is 1-800-Flowers group of companies, Harry and David and Popcorn Factory and so others. Now, with our automation, we saved them thousands of call center operators and people didn't have to wait. They got immediate hyper-personalized service. So that is where our technology is already being deployed right now, is in call center automation, but we're also really looking at other personal assistant type of applications on the commercial side.
And so with the hyper-personalized call center, now I'm giving personal information to AI. So what kind of protections should companies look at having in place for that?
So that's the beauty with the approach of cognitive AI, is you don't have this huge statistical model that everybody's information gets combined. With our approach, each individual customer has their own profile that's stored completely separately. So what you learn during a conversation with a customer that may be helpful on future conversations, like I'm buying chocolates for my niece for her birthday, and maybe next year, you know, you can suggest that chocolates, or they might be buying something for your niece. So that information will be kept per individual, and individuals can opt out of that, but it's not combined with other people. So that, again, is an advantage of a system that isn't just a statistical combination of things. So it's really hyper-personalization at scale for 20 million people in the case of, you know, 1-800-Flowers.
So are these two pieces of information kind of bifurcating? Like, on the one sense, companies that can collect information will say about what you're saying, niece and flowers, and then cross-check all that data and say, well, it turns out that, like, lots of people are buying for their nieces flower. You know, who knew that chocolates were being bought for nieces? Right. We need, you know, well, let's do a promo. Versus customized, where data is staying in the silo. How are those two things?
Right. Well, you know, that's really a policy for each company to decide what they want to do. But obviously, they have the capability of aggregating this data, hopefully, and, you know, in a totally anonymized way. But it can also be used for the individual if they opt in, you know, for example, for reminders or so. The policies are really up to the individual company to decide how they want to use the data. But the technology allows them to really completely separate it. And for the requirements of European Union, for example, that's fantastic, because you literally can go in and say, yes, I'm deleting all of the history for this one customer who wants to opt out. Can easily be done.
What do you think some of the biggest threats are? And I'm thinking cyber threats. I'm not thinking gray goo, but you could take us in that direction if you want. As humanity gets closer, I'll assume we'll get closer to AGI. What do we need to really be concerned about?
So I tend to believe that a lot of the problems we have with technology and with nascent AI is that it isn't intelligent enough. And that I think increased intelligence will actually make it safer. So I'm not really that concerned about risk from AI directly. But of course, humanity dealing with this radical abundance that AGI will create will be a large disruption. And again, I think AGI will help, because my vision is that everybody in the world will be able to have their own personal assistant that you own. It serves your agenda, not some mega corporation's agenda. It's hyper-personalized to you, and you control what it shares with whom. And that'll be like a friend and helper, and but also potentially a psychologist that can help you deal with this wealth. You know, I mean, we've all read stories where people who win the lottery often can't cope with it that well, you know, or who don't need to work or can't work anymore because maybe their personality and that is so tied up in their work. So most people you talk to say, if you ask them, do you want to win the lottery? And they say, of course, I would love to win the lottery, you know. And that's really what AGI promises in a way, is that everybody, it's like everybody winning the lottery, that you will not have to work or very little in order to afford a very luxurious lifestyle, because AI will bring down the cost of goods and services tremendously.
And then I expect that brings up just the human concern of the increased discrepancy then between people who have access to that personal assistant and people who don't. What is your take on how we humans move forward in that space? Is it just policy or?
Yeah, I mean, my own view is, and I hope I have some part to play in this, or that other people will come to the same conclusion, is that everybody in the world should have access to that. And I think there are some promising signs. I mean, everybody has access to ChatGPT. Well, I mean, people who have obviously have at least have internet, but that's very rapidly also pretty much everybody in the world. Presumably, there will still be a premium pricing model or something if you want to use it for research. But I think that a basic personal assistant like that will be available to everybody.
Would that be centralized computing then? I mean, you're saying the compute wouldn't have to be so huge. And right now, I know with LLMs, that's part of the situation, is you've got massively centralized compute power that one human is probably not going to afford or have space for.
Right.
So are we going to have distributed compute with AGI then?
Oh, yes. I mean, currently, the systems that we are building will run on a 5-year-old laptop. Now, of course, as we crank up the intelligence, that will require more computing power, but computing power constantly increases and the prices are dropping. So I see this personal assistant being able to run quite happily on a smartphone type device. And no, I don't see it at all as a very centralized kind of service. In fact, that's not desirable from my point of view, is that really anybody should have access to that core technology.
Well, Peter Voss, thank you very much for the conversation on artificial general intelligence and cognitive architecture. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
We hope you'll join us for the next episode of In Technology. In the meantime, follow Camille Morehart on LinkedIn to continue the conversation. That's Morehart, Morehart. Thanks for listening.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and author and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Intel Corporation.